Hi, welcome to the Talking Information Center's short story program, being read from here at the Talking Information Center. This is the short story written by the author A.S. Byatt, entitled The Thing in the Forest. And this story takes place during the Blitz, that is, during the period from 1940 to 41, when British cities were frequently bombed by German warplanes. Many children were evacuated from cities to safer locations in the countryside. And the story takes place in the country. This is the short story, A.S. Byatt's short story, The Thing in the Forest, being read from here at the Talking Information Center, being read for the Talking Information Center's short story program. There were once two girls, little girls, who saw or believed they saw a thing in the forest. The two little girls were evacuees who had been sent away from the city by train with a large number of other children. They had all their names attached to their coats with safety pins, and they carried little bags or satchels and their regulation gas mask. They wore knitted scarves and bonnets or caps, and many had knitted gloves attached to long tapes that ran along their sleeves, inside their coats, and over their shoulders and out, so that they could leave their 10 woolen fingers dangling, like a spare pair of hands, like a scarecrow. They had all bare legs and scuffed shoes and wrinkled socks. Most had wounds on their knees in varying stages of freshness and scabbiness. They were at the age when children fell often and their knees were often unprotected, with their suitcases, some of which were almost too big to carry, and their other impedimenta, a doll, a toy car, a comic. They were like a disorderly dwarf regiment, stomping along the platform. The two little girls had not met before and made friends on the train. They shared a square of chocolate and took alternate bites at an apple. Their names were Penny and Primrose. Penny was thin and dark and taller, possibly older than Primrose, who was plump and blonde and curly. Primrose had bitten nails and a velvet collar on her dressy green coat. Penny had a bloodless, transparent paleness, a touch of blue in her fine lips. Neither of them knew where they were going, nor how long the journey might take. They did not even know why they were going, since neither of their mothers had quite known how to explain the danger to them. "How do you say that to your child? I am sending you away, because enemy bombs may fall out of the sky. But I am myself staying here, in what I believe may be daily danger of burning, being buried alive, gas, and ultimately perhaps a gray army rolling in on tanks over the suburbs." So the mothers, who did not resemble each other at all, behaved alike and explained nothing. It was easier. Their daughters, they knew, were little girls who would not be able to understand or imagine. The girls discussed whether it was a sort of a holiday or a sort of a punishment, or maybe a bit of both. Both had the idea that these were all perhaps not very good children, possibly being sent away for that reason. They were pleased to be able to define each other as nice. They would stick together, they agreed. The train crawled sluggishly farther and farther away from the city and from their homes. It was not a clean train. The upholstery of their carriage had the dank smell of unwashed trousers and the gusts of hot steam rolling backward just past their windows that were full of specks of flimsy ash and sharp grit and occasionally fiery sparks that pricked face and fingers like hot needles if you opened the window. It was very noisy, too, whenever it picked up a little speed. The window panes were both grimy and misted up. The train stopped frequently, and when it stopped, they used their gloves to wipe rounds, through which they peered out at flooded fields, furrowed hillsides, and tiny stations whose names were carefully blacked out and whose platforms were empty of life. The children did not know that the namelessness was meant to baffle or delude an invading army. They felt, they did not think it out, but somewhere inside of them the idea sprouted that the erasure was because of them, because they were not meant to know where they were going, or, like Hansel and Gretel, to find their way back. They did not speak to each other of this anxiety, but began the conversation children have about things that they really dislike, things that upset or disgust or frighten them. Semolina pudding with its grainy texture, mushy peas, fat on roast meat, having your head held roughly back over the basin to have your hair washed, with cold water running down inside your Liberty bodice, gangs in playgrounds. They felt the pressure of all the other alien children in all the other carriages as a potential gang. They shared another square of chocolate, and they licked their fingers and looked out at a great white goose flapping its wings beside an inky pond. The sky drew dark gray, and in the end, the train halted. The children got out and lined up in a crocodile, and they were led to a mud-colored bus. Penny and Primrose managed to get a seat together, although it was over the wheel, and both of them began to feel sick as the bus bumped along the snaking country lanes under whipping branches with torn strips of thin cloud streaming across a full moon. They were billeted in a mansion commandeered from its owner. The children were told they were there temporarily until families were found to take them. Penny and Primrose held hands and said to each other that it would be a wizard if they could do the same family, and because they were looking at each other, they didn't say anything to the rather tired-looking ladies who were ordering them about, because, with the cunning of little children, they knew that requests were most often counterproductive. Adults liked saying no. They imagined possible families into which they might be thrust. They did not discuss what they imagined, as these pictures, like the black station signs, were too frightening, and words might make some horror solid in some magical way. Penny, who was a reading child, imagined Victorian dark pillars of sorority, like Jane Eyre's Mr. Brocklehurst or David Copperfield's Mr. Munstrone. Primrose imagined, she didn't know why, a fat woman with a white cap and round red arms who smiled nicely but made children wear sacking aprons and scrub the steps and the stove. "It's like we were orphans," she said to Penny. "But we're not," Penny said, "if we manage to stick together." The great house had a double flight of imposing stairs to its front door, and carved griffins and unicorns on its balustrade. There was no lighting because of the blackout. All the windows were shuttered. The children trudged up the staircase in their crocodile, which is a group of people lined up two by two, and they were given supper, which was Irish stew with rice pudding and a dollop of blood-red jam, before they were sent to bed in long makeshift dormitories where once servants had slept. They had camp beds, military issue, and gray, shoddy blankets. Penny and Primrose got beds together, but couldn't get a corner. They queued, they lined up, to brush their teeth in a tiny washroom, and both suffered, again without speaking, a suffocating anxiety about what would happen if they waited to pee in the middle of the night. They also suffered from a fear that in the dark the other children would start laughing and rushing and teasing and turn themselves into a gang. But that did not happen. Everyone was tired and anxious and orphaned. An easy silence, a drift of unperturbed sleep, came over them all. The only sounds from all parts of the great dormitory, it seemed, were suppressed snuffles and sobs from faces pressed into thin pillows. When daylight came, things seemed, as mostly they do, brighter and better. The children were given breakfast in a large vaulted room at trestle tables, partridge made with water and a dab of red jam, heavy cups of strong tea. Then they were told they could go out and play until lunchtime. Children in those days, wherever they came from, were not closely watched and were allowed to come and go freely, and those evacuated children were not herded into any kind of holding pen or transit camp. They were told they should be back for lunch at 12:30, by which time those in charge hoped to have sorted out their provisional future lives. It was not known how they would know when it was 12:30, but it was expected that, despite the fact that few of them had wristwatches, they would know how to keep an eye on the time. It was what they were used to. Penny and Primrose went out together in their respectable coats and laced shoes onto the terrace. The terrace appeared to them to be vast. It was covered with a fine layer of damp gravel, stained here and there bright green, or invaded by mosses. Beyond it was a stone balustrade with a staircase leading down to a lawn. Across the lawn was a sculpted yew hedge. In the middle of the hedge was a wicket gate, and beyond the gate were trees. A forest, the little girls said to themselves. Let's go into the forest, said Penny, as though the sentence were required of her. Primrose hesitated. Most of the other children were running up and down the terrace. Some of the boys were kicking a ball on the grass. Okay, said Primrose. We needn't go far. No, I've never been in a forest, nor me. We ought to look at it, though, while we've got this opportunity, said Penny. There was a very small child, one of the smallest, whose name, she told everyone, was Alice. With a Y, she told those who could spell, and those who couldn't, which surely included herself. She was barely out of nappies. She was quite extraordinarily pretty, pink and white, with large pale blue eyes and sparse little golden curls all over her head and neck, through which her pink skin could be seen. Nobody seemed to be in charge of her, no elder brother or sister. She had not quite managed to wash the tear stains from her dimpled cheeks. She had made several attempts to attach herself to Penny and Primrose. They did not want her. They were excited about meeting and liking each other. She said now, I'm coming too, into the forest. No, you aren't, said Primrose. You are too little. You must stay here, said Penny. You'll get lost, said Primrose. You won't get lost. I'll come with you, said the little creature, with an engaging smile made for loving parents and grandparents. We don't want you, you see, said Primrose. It's for your own good, said Penny. Alice went on smiling hopefully, the smile becoming more of a mask. It will be all right, said Alice. Run, said Primrose. And they ran. They ran down the steps and across the lawn, and through the gate into the forest. They didn't look back. They were long-legged little girls. The trees were silent round them, holding out their branches to the sun. Primrose touched the warm skin of the nearest saplings, taking off her gloves to feel the cracks and the knots. Penny looked into the thick of the forest. There was undergrowth, a mat of brambles and bracken. There were no obvious paths. Dark and light came and went, inviting and mysterious, as the wind pushed clouds across the face of the sun. We have to be careful not to get lost, she said. In stories, People make marks on tree trunks, or unroll a thread, or leave a trail of white pebbles to find their way back. We needn't go out of sight of the gate, said Primrose. We could just explore just a little bit. So they set off, very slowly. They went on tiptoe, making their own narrow passages through the undergrowth, which sometimes came as high as their thin shoulders. They were urban and unaccustomed to silence. Then they began to hear small sounds, the chatter and repeated lilt and alarms of invisible birds high up, further in, rustling in dry leaves, slitherings, dry coughs, sharp cracks. They went on, pointing out to each other creepers draped with glistening berries, crimson, black, and emerald, little drops of toadstools, some scarlet, some ghostly pale, some a dead flesh purple, some like tiny parasols, and some like pieces of meat protruding from tree trunks. They met blackberries, but didn't pick them, in case this place they were dangerous or deceptive. They admired from a safe distance the stiff, upright fruiting rods of the lords and ladies, packed with fat red berries. Did they hear it first, or did they smell it? Both sound and scent were at first infinitesimal and dispersed. They gave the strange impression of moving in waves, from the whole perimeter of the forest. Both increased very slowly in intensity, and both were mixed, a sound and a smell, fabricated of many disparate sounds and smells, a crunching, a crackling, a crushing, a heavy thumping, combining with threshing and thrashing, and added to that a gulping, heaving, boiling, bursting, streaming sound, full of bubbles and farts, piffs and explosions, swallowings and wallowings. The smell was worse and more aggressive than the sound. It was a liquid smell of putrefaction, the smell of maggoty things at the bottom of untended dustbins, blocked drains, mixed with the smell of bad eggs and of rotten carpets and ancient polluted bedding. The ordinary forest smells and sounds were extinguished. The two little girls looked at each other and took each other's hands. Speechlessly and instinctively, they crouched down behind a fallen tree trunk and trembled as the thing came into view. Now a break from the story. This is the Talking Information Center's short story program being read from here at the Talking Information Center. And this is the short story, The Thing in the Forest, written by the author A.S. Byatt. And now, back to the story. Its head appeared to form, or first become visible in the distance, between the trees. Its face, which was triangular, appeared like a rubbery or fleshy mask over a shapeless, sprouting bulb of a head, like a monstrous turnip. Its color was the color of flayed flesh, pitted with wormholes, and its expression was neither wrath nor greed, but pure misery. Its most defined feature was a vast mouth, pulled down and down at the corners, tight with a kind of pain. Its lips were thin and raised, like welts from whip strokes. It had blind, opaque white eyes, fringed with fleshy lashes and brows, like the feelers of sea anemones. Its face was close to the ground and moved toward the children between its forearms, which were squat, thick, powerful, and akimbo, like a cross between a washerwoman's and a primeval dragon's. The flesh on those forearms was glistening and mottled. The rest of its very large body appeared to be glued together, like still, wet papier-mâché, or the carapace of stones and straws and twigs worn by caddis flies underwater. It had a tubular shape, as a turd has a tubular shape, a provisional amalgam. It was made of rank meat and decaying vegetation, but it also trailed vase and prostheses of man-made materials, bits of wire netting, foul dishcloths, wire wool full of pan scrubbings, rusty nuts and bolts. It had feeble stumps and stubs of very slender legs, growing out of all angles, wavering and rippling like the suckered feet of a caterpillar or the squirming fringe of a centipede. On and on it came, bending and crushing whatever lay in its path, including bushes, though not substantial trees, which it wound between awkwardly. The little girls observed with horrified fascination that when it met a sharp stone or a narrow tree trunk, it allowed itself to be sliced through, flowed sluggishly round in two or three smaller worms, convulsed and reunited. Its progress was apparently very painful, for it moaned and whined among its other burblings and belchings. They thought it could not see, or certainly could not see clearly. It and its stench passed within a few feet of their tree trunk, humping along, leaving behind it a trail of bloody slime and dead foliage. Its end was flat and blunt, almost transparent, like some earthworms. When it had gone, Penny and Primrose, kneeling on the moss and the dead leaves, put their arms about each other and hugged each other, shaking with dry sobs. They often stood up, and still silent, they stared together, hand in hand, at the trail of obliteration and destruction, which wound out of the forest and into it again. They went back, hand in hand, without looking behind them, afraid that the wicked gate, the lawn, the stone steps, the balustrade, the terrace, and the great house would be transmogrified, or simply not there. But the boys were still there playing football on the lawn. A group of girls were skipping and singing shrilly on the gravel. They let go of each other's hands, and they went back in. They did not speak to each other again. The next day, they were separated and placed with strange families. Their stay in these families, Primrose was in a dairy farm, Penny was in a parsonage, did not, in fact, last very long, though then the time that seemed in slow motion and endless. Later, Primrose remembered the sound of milk spurting in the pail, and Penny remembered the empty corsets of the vicar's wives, hanging bony on the line. They remembered dandelion clocks, but you can remember those from anywhere, any time. They remembered the things they had seen in the forest. On the contrary, in the way you remember those very few dreams, almost all nightmares, that have the quality of life itself. Though what are dreams, if not life itself? They remembered, too, solid flesh, too precise a stink, a rattle, and sewing that is thrilled in the nerves and the cartilage of their growing ears. In the beginning and in memory, as in such a dream, they felt, I cannot get out, and this is a real thing in a real place. They returned from the evacuation, like many evacuees, so early that then they lived through wartime in the city, bombardment, blips, unearthly light and roaring, changed landscapes, holes in their world where the newly dead had been. Both lost their fathers. Primrose's father was in the army, and he was killed very late in the war on a crowded troop carrier sunk in the Far East. Penny's father, a much older man, was in the auxiliary fire service and died in a sheet of flame in the East India docks on the Thames, pumping evaporating water from a puny coil of a hose. They found it hard, after the war, to remember these different men. The claspers of memory could not grip to the drowned and the burned. Primrose saw an inane grin under a khaki cap because her mother had a snapshot. Penny thought she remembered her father, already gray-headed, brushing ash off his boots and trousers as he put on his tin hat to go out. She thought she remembered a quaver of fear in his tired face and the muscles composing themselves into resolution. It was not much of what either of them had remembered. After the war, their fates were still similar and dissimilar. Penny's widowed mother embraced grief, closed her face with curtains. Brimrose's mother married one of her many admirers she'd had before the ship went down, and gave birth to another 5 children, and developed varicose veins and a smoker's cough. She dyed her blonde hair with peroxide when it faded. Both Primrose and Penny were only children who now, because of the war, lived in amputated or unreal families. Penny was a good student, and in due course went to the university, where she chose to study developmental psychologies. Primrose had little education. She was always being kept off school to look after the others. She, too, dyed her blonde curls with peroxide when they turned mousy and faded. She got fat as Penny got thin. Neither of them married. Penny became a child psychologist, working with the abused, the displaced, the disturbed. Primrose did this and that. She was a barmaid. She worked in a shop. She went to help at various church creches and Salvation Army gatherings, and she discovered that she had a talent for storytelling. She became Auntie Primrose with her own repertoire. She was employed to tell tales to kindergartens and to entertain at children's parties. She was much in demand at Halloween and had her own circle of bright-colored plastic chairs in a local shopping mall where she kept an eye on the children of Burden Woman, keeping them safe, offering them just a frisson of fear or terror, which made them wriggle with pleasure. The house in the country aged differently. Over this period of time, while the little girls became women, it was handed over to the nation, which turned it into a living museum. Guided tours took place in it at regulated times. During these tours, the ballroom and the intimate drawing rooms were fenced off with crimson twisted ropes on little brass one-eyed pedestals. The bored and the curious peered in at the four-poster beds and the pink sink fatuels, at silver-framed photographs of wartime royalty and crackling, crazing, Renaissance and Enlightenment portraits. In the room where the evacuees had eaten their rationed meals, the history of the house was displayed on posters, in glass cases, with helpful notices and opened copies of old diaries and records. There is no mention of the evacuees, whose presence appeared to have been too brief to have left any trace. The two women met in this room on an autumn day in 1984. They had come with a group, walking in a chattering crocodile behind a guide. They prowled around the room, each alone with herself, in opposite directions, each without acknowledging the other's presence. Their mothers had died that spring, within a week of each other, though this coincidence was unknown to them. It had made both of them think of taking a holiday, and both had chosen that part of the world. Penny was wearing a charcoal trouser suit and a black velvet hat. Primrose wore a floral knit long jacket over a shell pink cashmere sweater, over a rustling long skirt with an elastic waist and a mustard-colored tapestry print. Her hips and bosom were bulky. Both of them, at the same time, leaned over an image in a medieval-looking illustrated book. Primrose thought it was a very old book. Penny assumed it was a 19th-century mock medieval. It showed a knight on foot in a forest, lifting his sword to slay something. The night shone on the righted slope of the page in the light which caught the gilding on his helmet and sword belt. It was not possible to see what was being slain. This was because, both in the tangled vegetation of the image and in the way the book was displayed in the case, the enemy, or the victim, was in shadows. Neither of them could read the ancient, or pseudo-ancient, black letter of the text beside the illustration. There was a typed description under the book. They had to lean forward to read it, and to see what was worming its way into, or out of, the deep spine of the book. And that was how each came to see the other's face, close up, in the glass, which was both transparent and reflective. Their transparent faces lost detail, cracked lipstick, pouches, fine lines of wrinkles, and they both looked younger and grayer, less substantial. And that is how they came to recognize each other, as they might not have done, plump face to bony face. They breathed each other's names, Penny, Primrose, and their breath misted the glass, obscuring the knight and his opponent. "I could have died. I could have wet my knickers," said Penny and Primrose afterward to each other, and both experienced this moment, this still moment, as pure, dangerous shock. They read the caption, which was about the loathly worm, which tradition held had infested the countryside and been killed more than once by scions of that house. Sir Lyle, Sir Boris, Sir Gillam, the worm, the typewriter had tapped out, was an English worm and not a European dragon, and like most worms, was wingless. In some sightings, it was reported as having vestigial legs, hands, or feet. In others, it was limbless. It had, in monstrous form, the capacity of common or garden worms to sprout new heads or trunks if it was divided, so that two worms or more replaced one. This was what had killed it so often, yet reappeared. It had reported traveling with a slithering pack of young ones, but these may have been revitalized segments only. Being English, they thought of tea. There was a tea room in the great house, in a converted stable in the back. There they stood, silently side by side, clutching floral plastic trays, spread with briar roses, and purchased scones, superior raspberry jam in tiny jam jars, little plastic tubs of clotted cream. "You couldn't get cream or real jam in the war," said Primrose, as they found a corner table. She said wartime rationing had made her permanently greedy, and Thin Penny agreed that it had. Clotted cream was still a treat. They watched each other warily, offering bland snippets of autobiography in hushed voices. Primrose thought Penny looked gaunt, and Penny thought Primrose looked rattled. They established a skein of coincidences, dead fathers, unmarried status, child-caring professions, recently dead mothers. Circling like beaters, they approached the covert thing in the forest. They discussed in the great house politely. Primrose admired the quality of the carpets. Penny said it was nice to see old pictures hanging on the wall. Primrose said, "Funny, really, that all the history, but no sign that the children that had ever actually been there. Funny, that," Penny said, "that they should meet each other next to that book with that picture." "Creepy," said Primrose, in a light, cobweb voice, not looking at Penny. "We saw that thing when we went in the forest." "Yes, we did," said Penny. "We saw it." "Did you ever wonder," asked Primrose, "if we really saw it?" "Never for a moment," said Penny. "That is, I don't know what it was, but I've always been quite sure that we saw it." "Does it change? Do you remember all of it?" "It was a horrible thing, yes. I remember all of it. There isn't a bit of it that I can manage to forget, though I forgot all sorts of things," said Penny, in a thin, vanishing voice. "And have you ever told anyone of it, ever spoken of it?" asked Primrose, more urgently, leaning forward. "No," said Penny. "She had not. She said, who would believe it?" "That's what I thought," said Primrose. "I didn't speak, but it stuck in my mind, like a tapeworm in your gut. I think it did me no good." "It did me no good either," said Penny. "No good at all. I've thought about it, she said to the aging woman opposite her, whose face quivered under her dyed Goldilocks. I think there are things that are real, more real than we are, but mostly we don't cross their paths, or they don't cross ours. Maybe at very bad times we get into their world, or notice what they're doing in ours. Primrose nodded energetically. She looked as though she was sharing solace. Penny, to whom it was not solace, grimaced with pain. Sometimes I think that thing finished me off, Penny said to Primrose, a child's voice rising in a woman's gullet, arousing a little girl's scared smile, which wasn't a smile on Primrose's face. Primrose said, it did finish her off, that little one, didn't it? She got into its path, didn't she? And whether it had gone by, she wasn't anywhere, said Primrose. That's how it was. Nobody ever asked where she was or looked for her, said Penny. I wonder if we made her up, said Primrose. But I didn't. We didn't. Her name was Alice, with a Y. There had been such a mess, a disgusting mess, they remembered, but no particular sign of what might have been or part of been belonged to the little persistent girl named Alice. Primrose shrugged voluptuously, let out a gale of a sigh, and rearranged her flesh in her clothes. Well, we know we're not mad, anyway. We got into a mystery, but we didn't make it up. It wasn't a delusion, so it was good we met, because now we needn't be afraid we're mad. Need we? Can we get on with things, so to speak? They arranged to have dinner the following evening. They were staying in different bed and breakfasts, and neither of them thought exchanging addresses. They agreed on a restaurant in the market square of the local town, Serafina's Hot Pot, and at a time, 7:30. They did not even discuss spending the next day together. Primrose went on a local bus tour. Penny took a long, solitary walk. The weather was gray, spitting fine rain. Both arrived at their lodgings with headaches, and both made tea with the tea bags and kettle provided in their rooms. They sat on their beds. Penny's had a quilt with a blousy cabbage roses. Primrose's had a black and white checked gingham duvet. They turned on their televisions, watched the same game show, listened to the inordinate jolly laughter. 7:30 came and went, and neither woman moved. Both indistinctly imagined the other waiting at a table, watching a door open and shut. Neither moved. What could they have said, they asked themselves, but only perfunctorily. The next day, Penny thought about the wood, put on her walking shoes, and set off obliquely in the opposite direction. Primrose sat over her breakfast, which was English and ample. The wood, the real and imagined wood, before and after she had entered with Penny, had always been a simultaneous source of attraction and of discomfort, shading into terror. Without speaking to herself a sentence in her head, I shall go there, Primrose decided, and she went straight there, full of warm food, arriving in the morning brightened with the first busload of tourists, and giving them the slip to take the path they had once taken, across the lawn and through the wicket gate. The wood was very much the same, but denser and more inviting in its new greenness. Primrose's body decided to set off in a rather different direction from the one the little girls had taken. New bracken was uncoiling with snaky force. Yesterday's rain still glittered on limp, new hazel leaves and threads of gossamer. Small feathered throats above her whistled and trilled with enchanting territorial aggression and male self-assertion, which were to Primrose simply the chorus. She found a mossy bank with posies of primroses, which she recognized and took vaguely as a good sign, a personal sign. She was better at flowers than birds, because there had been flower fairies in the school bookshelves when she was little, with the flowers painted accurately, accompanied by pretty, truly human creatures, all children clothed in blues and golds, russets and purples of flowers and fruits. Here she saw and recognized them, windflower and bryony, self-heal and dead nettle, and head, despite what she was, a lovely, overlapping sense of invisible, just invisible life, swarming in the leaves and along the twigs. She stopped. She did not like the sound of her own toiling breath. She was not very fit. She saw them then, a whisking in the bracket, a twirl of fur, thin and flaming, quivering on a tree trunk. She saw a squirrel, a red squirrel, watching her from a bough. Then, from that bough, she had to sit down, as she remembered her mother. She sat on a hummock of grass, rather heavily. She remembered them all, Nutkin and Moldy Warp, Brock and Sleepy Dormouse, Fatty Newt and Freddy Frog. She remembered them all from then she had seen, and in the remembering, she brought back to childhood from her own time, from how she had been. And her mother hadn't told stories and hadn't opened gates into imaginary worlds, but she had been good with her fingers. Every Christmas during the war, when toys and indeed materials were not to be had, Primrose had woken to find her stocking a new stuffed creature made from fur fabric with button eyes and horny claws. There had been an artistry to them. The stuffed squirrel was the essence of a squirrel. The fox was watchful. The newt was slithery. They did not wear anthropomorphic jackets or caps, which made it easier to invest them in imaginary creatures. She believed in Father Christmas, and the discovery that her mother had made the toys, the vanishing of the magic, had been a breathtaking blow. She could not be grateful for the skill and the imagination, so uncharacteristic of her flirtatious mother. The creatures continued to accumulate, a spider, a Bambi. She told herself stories at night about a girl woman, an enchantress, in a fairy wood, loved and protected by an army of wise and gentle animals. She slept, banked in by stuffed creatures, as in the house the Blitz was banked in by the inadequate sandbags. Primrose registered the red squirrel as disappointing, stringier and more rat-like than its plump gray city cousins, but she knew it was special, and when it took off from branch to branch, flicking its extended tail like a sail, gripping with tiny hands, she set out to follow it. It would take her to the center, she thought. It could easily have leapt out of sight, she thought, but it didn't. She pushed through the brambles into denser, greener shadows. Juices stained her skirts and her skin. She began to tell herself a story about staunch Primrose, not giving up, making her way to the center. Her childhood stories had all been in third person. She was not afraid. She faced up to the wild beasts. They cowered. She laddered her tights and muddied her shoes and breathed heavier. The squirrel stopped to clean its face. She brushed bluebells and saw the sinister hoods of arum lilies. She had no idea of how far she had gone, but she decided that the clearing, where she had found herself, was the center. The squirrel had stopped and was running up and down a single tree. There was a mossy mound that could have been a throne-like aspect, if you were being imaginative. So she sat on it. She came to the center, and she sat on the mossy chair. Now what? She had forgotten what they had seen, the blank, miserable face, the powerful claws, the raggle-taggle train of accumulated decay. She had come neither to look for it nor to confront it, but she had come because it was there. She had known all her life that she, Primrose, had rarely been in a magic forest. She knew that the forest was the source of terror. She had never frightened the little ones she'd entertained with the tales of lost children in the forest. She frightened them with slimy things that came up the plug hole or swarmed out of the U-bend in the lavatory and were dispatched by bravery and magic, but the woods in her tales bred glamour. They were places where words used like prangles and sequins and for real dewdrops and real dark leaves. Primrose knew that glamour and the thing they had seen, brilliance and ashen, stink, came from the same place. She made things safe for the little ones by restricting them to pantomime flats and sweet illustrations. She didn't look at what she knew, better not. She did know what she knew, recognized confusedly. Now what? She sat on the moss, and a voice in her head said, "I want to go home." She heard herself give a bitter, entirely grown-up laugh. For what was home? What did she know about home? Where she lived was above a Chinese takeaway. She had a dangerous cupboard corner she cooked in, a bed, a closed rail, an armchair deformed by generations of bottoms. She thought of this place in faded browns and beiges, seen through drifting coils of Chinese cooking steam, scented with stewing pork and a bubbling chicken broth. Home was not real, as all sturdy twigs and roots in the wood were not real. The stuffed animal was piled on the bed and the carpet. Their fur was rubbed, the pristine stare gone from the scratched eyes. She thought about one that was real, sitting there in the moss throne at the center. When Mum had come in, sniveling, to say Dad was dead, Primrose herself had been preoccupied with whether pudding would be tapioca or semolina, whether there would be jam, and subsequently how ugly Mum's dripping nose was, and how she looked as though she were putting it on. She remembered the semolina and the rather nasty blackberry jam, the taste and the texture to this day. So what was real? What was home? She later invented a picture of a cloudy aquamarine sea under a gold sun in which a huge fountain of white curling water rose from a foundering ship. It was very beautiful, but not real. She could not remember Dad. She could not remember the thing in the forest, and she could remember Alice. The thing that the mossy stump had lovely colors, crimson and emeralds, didn't mean she didn't remember the thing. She remembered what Penny had said about things that are more real than we are. She had met one. Here at the center, the spout of water was more real than semolina, because of which the thing rains. The word she found now was rain. She'd understood something, and did not know what she'd understood. She wanted badly to go home, and she wanted never to move. The light was lovely in the leaves. The squirrel flitted its tail and suddenly set off again, springing into the branches. The woman lumbered to her feet and licked the bramble scratches on the backs of her hands. Penny had walked steadily, keeping to the hedgerows and the field-edge paths. She remembered the thing. She remembered it clearly and daily, but she walked away, noticing and not noticing that her path was deflected by field forms and the lay of the land into a snaking sickle shape. As the day wore on, she settled into her stride, and she lifted her eyes. When she saw the wood on the horizon, she knew from which it had appeared to be perched, on an unforbiddable aspect in a conical hillock, ridged as though it had been grasped and squeezed by coils of strength. It was almost dusk. She mounted the slope, and she went in over a suddenly discovered stile. Once inside, she moved cautiously. She stood rock still, and she snuffed the air, for it reminded her of the rottenness. She listened to the sounds of the trees and the creatures. She smelled the rottenness, but it was normal rottenness, leaves and stems mulching into the earth. She heard sounds, not birdsong, for it was too late in the day, but the odd raucous of a warning croak. She heard her own heartbeat in the thickening brown air. It was no use for familiar trees or tussocks. They had a lifetime, her lifetime, to alter out of recognition. She began to think that she had to discern dark tunnels in the undergrowth, where something might have toiled from that and then slid. Mashed seedlings, broken twigs, and fronds, none of it very recent. There were things caught in the thorns, flimsy, colorless shreds of damp wool or fur. She peered down the tunnels, and she noted where the scrapings hung thickest. She forced herself to go into the dark, stooping, occasionally crawling on hands and knees. The silence was heavy. She found threadworms of knitting, wool, unraveled dishcloth, cotton, clinging newsprint. She found odd sausage-shaped tubes of membrane containing fragments of hair and bone and inanimate stuffs. Then there were the monstrous owl pellets or gut-shaped hairballs omitted and vomited by cats. Penny went forward, putting aside briars and tough stems with careful fingers. It had been hair, but how long ago? Quite suddenly, she came out at a place she remembered. The clearing was larger, the tree trunks were thicker, but the great log behind which they had hidden was still there. The place was almost like the ghost of a camp. The trees were hung around with pennants and streamers, like the scorched, hack, threadbare banners in the chapel of a great house, with their brown stains of earth or blood. It had been here. It had never gone away. Penny looked and moved slowly and dreamily around, looking for things. She found mock tortoise shell hair slide and a shoe button with a metal shank. She found a bird skeleton, quite fresh, bashed flat. She found ambivalent shards and teeth of varying sizes and shapes. She found, spread around, half hidden by the roots, stained green but glinting white, a collection of small bones, finger bones, tiny toes, a rib, and perhaps what might be a brain pen and brow. She thought of putting them in her knapsack, and she thought she could not. She was not an anatomist. The tiny bones could not have been that of a badger or a fox. She sat down with her back against a fallen tree. She thought, now I am watching myself as you do, in a safe dream. But then, when I saw it, it was one of those dreams where you are inside and cannot get out, except that it wasn't a dream. It was the encounter with the thing that led her to deal professionally in dreams. Something that resembled unreality had lumbered into reality, and she had seen it. She had been the reading of a child, but after the sight of the thing, she had not been able to inhabit the customary and charming unreality of books. She had become too good at studying what could not be seen. She took an interest in the dead, who inhabited real history. She was drawn to the invisible forces that moved in molecules and caused them to coagulate or dissipate. She became a psychotherapist to be useful. That was not quite accurate. The corner of the blanket that covered the unthinkable had been turned back enough for her to catch sight of it. She was in its world. It was not by accident that she had come to specialize in severely autistic children who twittered or banged or stared, who sat damp and absent in Penny's official lap and told her no dreams. The world they knew was a real world. Often Penny thought it was the real world, from which their even desperate parents were at least partly shielded. Somebody had to occupy themselves with the hopeless, and Penny felt that she could. All the leaves of the forest began slowly to quaver and then to clatter. Far away there was a sound of something heavy and sluggish stirring. Penny sat very still and expectant. She heard the old rumble. She sniffed the old stink. It came from no direction. It was all around, as though the thing encompassed the wood, or as though it traveled in multiple fragments. It was described in the old text. It was dark now. What was visible had no distinct color, only shades of ink and elephant. Now, thought Penny, just as suddenly as it began, the turmoil ceased. It was as if the thing had turned away, and she could feel the tremble of the wood recede and become still. Quite rapidly, over the treetops, a huge disk of white gold mounted and hung. Penny remembered her father, standing in the cold light of the full moon, and saying wryly that the bombers would not come tonight. They were safe under a cloudless full moon. He had vanished in an oven of red-yellow roaring, Penny had guessed or had been told or imagined. Her mother had sent her away before allowing the fireman to speak, who had come with the news. She had a creep mouse on stairs and cubbyholes, trying to overhear what was being imparted. Her mother didn't or couldn't want her company. She caught old phrases of nothing really to identify, absolutely no doubt. He had been a tired gentleman with ash in his trouser turnips. There was no funeral. Penny remembered thinking there was nothing, next to nothing, in the coffin of his fellow fireman shouldered. It went up so slightly and lightly. It was so easy to sit down. They had been living behind the blackout curtain anyway, but her mother went on living behind those drawn curtains long after the war was over. The moon had released the wood, it seemed. Penny stood up, brushed mold off her clothes. She had been ready for it, and it had not come. She felt disappointed, but she accepted her release and found her way back to the fields and her village along liquid trails of the moonlight. The two women took the same train back to the city, but did not encounter each other until they got out. The passengers scurried and shuffled down the exit, mostly with their heads down. Both women remembered how they had set out in wartime dark with their twig legs and gas masks. Both raised their heads as they neared the barrier, not in hope of being met for who they could be, but automatically to calculate where they could go and what to do. They saw each other's faces in the cavernous gloom, two pale, recognizable rounds, far enough apart for speech and even greetings to be awkward. In the dimness, they were reduced to similarity, dark eye holes, set mouth. For a moment or two, they stood and simply stared. On that first occasion, the station vault had been full of curling steam, and the air gritty with ash. Now the blunt-nosed, sleek vessel they had left was blue-gold under a layer of grime. They saw each other through the black imagined veil that grief or pain or despair hangs over the visible world. Each saw the other's face and thought of the unforgettable misery of the face they had seen in the forest. Each thought that the other was witness who made the thing real and who prevented from slipping into the comfort of believing she had imagined or made it up. So they stared at each other blankly, without acknowledgment, then picked up their baggage and turned away into the crowd. Penny found that the black veil had somehow become part of her vision. She thought constantly about faces, her mother's, Primrose's face, the hopeful little girl, the woman staring up at her from the glass case, in the sweet conspiratorial clotted cream, the blonde infant Alice, an ingratiating smile, the half-human face of the thing. She tried to remember the face completely, and suffered over the detail of the dreadful droop of its mouth, the exact inanity of its squinting. Present faces were blank disks, shadowed moons. Her patience came and went. She was increasingly unable to distinguish one from the other. The face of the thing hung on her brain, jealously, soliciting her attention, distracting her from dailiness. She had gone back to its place, but she had not seen it. She needed to see it. Why she needed to see it was more real than she was. She would go and face it. What else was there, she asked herself, and answered herself nothing. So she made her way back again, sitting alone in the train as the field streaked past, drowsing through a century-long night under the cabbage quilt in the B&B. This time she went in the old way, from the house, through the garden gate, and she found the old trail quickly. Her sharp eye picked up the trace of its detritus, and she was scurrying through the clearing, with her can of bones and the dare trunk undisturbed. She gave a little sigh, and she dropped to her knees through the rotting wood, and she silently called the thing. Almost immediately, she sensed its perturbation, and she saw the trouble. She closed her eyelids, and then when it came, she would face it face to face. Her nerve relaxed. She was ready. Primrose was in the shopping mall, putting out her circle of rainbow-colored things, and then plastic chairs. She creaked as she bent over them. It was pouring with rain outside, but the mall was enclosed with a crystal palace, encasing glass. The floor under the rainbow chairs was gleaming with dappled marble. They were in front of the dimpling fountain, with the light shining through the greenish water, making golden rings around the polished pebbles and wishing coins that lay there. The little children collected around her. Their mothers kissed them goodbye and told them to be good and quiet and listen to the nice lady. They had a little transparent plastic cups, shining orange juice, with each a biscuit in silver foil. They had all the colors, black skin, brown skin, pink skin, freckled skin, pink jacket, yellow jacket, purple hood, scarlet hood. Some grinned and some whimpered. Some wriggled. Some were still. Primrose sat on the edge of the fountain. She had decided what to do. She smiled her best, and her most comforting smile, and she adjusted her golden locks. "Listen to me," she told them, "and I'll tell you something, an amazing story that's never been told before. There were once two little girls who saw, or believed they saw, a thing in the forest." That was the short story written by the author A.S. Byatt, entitled The Thing in the Forest, and that was read from here at the Talking Information Center, read for the Talking Information Center's short story program. Thanks a lot for listening, and please do listen again. Take care, and goodbye, everybody.